So tonight's talk is taken from a sutta in the Anguttara Sutta. And Anguttara basically means numerical. So this is like a compilation of suttas based on the number of things in them, which is I want to talk a little bit about this before I actually talk about the particular sutta. The Buddha's taught for 40 years. He taught a lot of things, lots of different suttas. And many of them had numbers in them, like the four this, the five that, the ten this, like tonight. And the part of the reason for that was that it made it easier for people, particularly the Sangha, to remember them because they had this numerical rhythm to them. And also it was easier for them to remember and memorize because all of the sutta originally was not written down. Nothing was written down for about 200 years after the Buddha left his body. So the numerical method of helping you memorize, like, oh yeah, there's the eight this, oh wait, oh yeah, one, yeah, you can sort of see the eight in your head, and then that leads you to remembering the entire sutta. And so that's part of why he taught that way. Also just made it easier for people to understand in general. People got numerical things easier somehow. So this particular sutta is called the Ten Noble Abodes. There are, O monks, these ten noble abodes where the noble ones who have abided in the past, where they abide at present, and where they will abide in the future. What ten? Here, monks, a monk has abandoned five factors, possesses six factors, has a single guard, has a fourfold support, has driven away the many separate truths, has given up seeking, has clarified his thoughts, has calmed down his bodily formation, and has become well liberated in mind and well liberated by wisdom. And if that sentence makes your mind sort of short circuit, welcome to the club. Because he's basically referring to, and the rest of the sutta really breaks down each of these things and refers to each one of these teachings, because he's actually referring to specific teachings and sort of summing them all up in one place. I want to talk a little bit about the word abode, or that they abide. So an abode is where you live, right? And but he's not talking about the physical abode. He's talking about the mental place. This is where mentally people who were the noble ones, people who had become arhats, this is where they lived at the mental level. And so this is, in some senses, a somewhat progressive description of the process that monks went through to become enlightened. It's one of several suttas like this, but this one is, I came across this and said, oh, this is an interesting list, right? And I became fascinated by it. So that's like, okay. So let's start here with number one, right? And how has a monk abandoned five factors? Here, monks, a monk has abandoned sensual desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and worry, and doubt. Thus he has abandoned five factors. Well, these five factors are, of course, the five kilesas. So this is like the five things that he has abandoned. Abandoned meaning he no longer, or she no longer, is affected by them. And I wanted to actually read something from the Majjhima Nikaya that references this idea. And so, let's see. Oops. There we go. I got my sticker in the wrong place. Okay. And here the Buddha is talking about this same thing. He's talking about the five hindrances. And he's talking about how a monk might do that, actually make this happen. On returning from his alms rounds, after his meal, he sits down, folding his legs crosswise, sitting his body erect, and establishing mindfulness before him. Abandoning covetousness for the world, he abides with a mind free from covetousness. He purifies his mind from covetousness. Abandoning ill will and hatred, he abides with a mind free from ill will, compassionate for the welfare of all living beings. So he's giving that same list that he sort of gives this in brief here, but now he's explaining the benefits of this, right? Abandoning sloth and torpor, he abides free of sloth and torpor, recipient of light, mindful and fully aware. He purifies his mind from sloth and torpor. Abandoning restlessness and remorse, he abides unagitated with a mind inwardly peaceful. He purifies his mind from restlessness and remorse. Abandoning doubt, he abides having gone beyond doubt, unperplexed about wholesome states. He purifies his mind from doubt. Having thus abandoned these five hindrances, imperfections of the mind that weaken wisdom, quite secluded from sensual pleasure and secluded from unwholesome states, he enters and abides upon deep concentration states. So he's saying, this is the sort of, in some sense, is the prerequisite to deeper states of concentration, which is part of the process. Notice this is the first one. This is the beginning. And you see this a lot in the Buddhist teachings and in various places where he's talking about having to get past the kleshas, abandon them is the word that's typically used, which means if you look up abandon in the dictionary, it says something like completely do away with. In other words, you no longer are reactive to the kleshas when they arise. One other interesting thing. In the Satipatthana Sutta, when you get to the fourth foundation of mindfulness, what's the first thing we have to understand? Oh, there we are, the kleshas again. So this is a constant theme where we're going and looking at these progressive processes. It's always, this is what we have to work with first. And it's not like, we got to be careful we don't think these things are bad. We're bad if we experience these things. We're not. It's just we're normal human beings. It's just that they get in the way. They interfere with becoming more deeply mindful. That's why it's so important. That's why he mentions it so prominently. Ah, okay. And how has the monk possess six factors? Having abandoned five, he possesses six. Here, monks, having seen a form with the eye, a monk is neither elated nor dejected, but he dwells equanimous, mindful and clearly comprehending. And so too, when he hears a sound with the ear, smells an odor with the nose, savors a taste with the tongue, contacts a tactile object with the body, or cognizes a mind object with the mind. In this way, he possesses six factors. So here he's saying, not only are we not affected by the kleshas, we're also not affected by what's arising at the six sense doors. That the six sense doors are just stuff happening, but we're neither elated nor dejected. Just like equanimous. It's like, oh, that's okay. And it doesn't matter what's arising. Where you stay equanimous no matter what. Once again, there's another source for this same idea. This is from the Samyutta Nikaya. Bhikkhus, I will teach you the Dhamma for abandoning all. And what, bhikkhus, is the Dhamma for abandoning all? The I is to be abandoned. Forms are to be abandoned. I consciousness is to be abandoned. I contact is to be abandoned. And whatever feelings arise with eye contact as condition, whether pleasant or painful, or neither pleasant nor painful, that too is to be abandoned. And then he goes through exactly the same words, essentially, for the other five sense doors. So notice that what he's really laying out here is he's saying, here's the progression of how things happen. Something arises, and we react to it. Remember I talked about Vedana a couple of weeks ago, where he's talking about this idea of once contact has arisen, then Vedana arises, feeling tone, this idea that something is either pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And if we've abandoned reacting to Vedana, then once again the mind goes still. We're not caught up in the habitual patterns of reaction that we often go through with these things. Okay, moving on. He says, and how does a monk have a single guard? Here, monks, a monk possesses a mind guarded by mindfulness. In this way, he has a single guard. So mindfulness guards the mind. It's an interesting way to think about it. But when you're mindful, and you will be more likely to see things arising that would, if you weren't being mindful, would distract you. And off you'd go into some long thought process about what just arose, whatever it happens to be. But with mindfulness, the mindfulness guards the mind in the sense of going, oh, I know that one. I don't need to go there. Not getting caught. That's how it guards the mind. In the Satipatthana Sutta, you know, the Buddhist instructions on mindfulness, every set of instructions has a refrain, and the last sentence of the refrain is always, and he abides independent, not clinging to anything. So where mindfulness guards us from clinging to what's arising, making it into self, making it into something important, getting caught up in it, reacting to it on an emotional level. We're just going, nah, that's all okay. It's all okay. Not getting caught. That's how mindfulness guards the door, the self. It's supported in four, is the next one. And how does a monk have a fourfold support? Here, monks, a monk uses things after reflection, endures some things after reflection, avoids some things after reflection, and dispels some things after reflection. In this way, a monk has a fourfold support. Got that one, huh? It's like, what is this? I remember reading this the first time I read this. Like, what's he talking about? It's like, I mean, you sort of get a drift. It's like, he uses some things after reflection, endures some things, avoids some things, and dispels some things. But what he's actually referring to, and this is in the commentaries on this, in a footnote that I came across. It's interesting, you sort of keep digging down through more layers, you come across little fascinating tidbits. And this is the footnote. The explanation of this passage, in brief, he uses the four requisites, robes, alms food, lodgings, and medicine, after reflecting on them, like reflecting on them saying, ah, this is what I actually need, and nothing more than that. He endures painful feelings. So this is like, we're not, when unwholesome, difficult, painful feelings arise, whether they're physical or mental, emotional, he endures. It's like, Oh, okay. Right now, this is what I got. And that's okay. He endures. He avoids physical dangers. It's like, oh, wait, you got to keep this body alive. So don't do stuff that's going to get your body wrecked. Very practical sort of idea, really. But I think it's like that's part of what the Buddha kept saying to his Sangha. It was like, you got this body, who knows how long it'll be useful, so take care of it. Take care of it. Avoid physical dangers. And he dispels unwholesome thoughts. And there's all those things we've talked about ways to dispel unwholesome thoughts that are repetitive. I mean, initially, when an unwholesome thought arises, we have to look at it and go, oh, yeah, that's part of me. That's mine arising in this form. It's not always going to be sweetness and light. Sometimes it's going to be unwholesome. And sort of sit with that and be okay with it. But at a certain point, when we have looked at those things several times in detail, at that point it might be wiser to dispel them. And there's a variety of teachings about how to dispel them. Things like shifting the mind to something wholesome, like metta, being the classic one. Okay, so that's this one here, supported by four. Then he would come, and how has a monk driven away the many separate truths? Here, monks, there are many separate truths held by diverse ascetics and Brahmins, such as the world is eternal. The world is not eternal. The world is finite. The world is infinite. The soul is one thing and the body another. Or the body and the soul are the same. The Tathagata exists after death. Or the Tathagata does not exist after death. Or the Tathagata both exists and does not exist after death. Or the Tathagata neither exists nor does not exist after death. This is a classic list. A monk has discarded all these, driven them away, denounced and rejected them, released, abandoned, and relinquished them. In this way, a monk has driven away the many separate truths. Remember that at the time of the Buddha, there were lots of teachers. There was lots of sects, lots of different groups of people, not teaching a variety of things. And a lot of them had very strong, distinct views on certain things like the world is finite, the world is infinite, those sorts of things. And the Buddha really strongly emphasized how useless those ideas were. I mean, I can't put it any other way. It's like, trying to figure out whether is the world infinite or finite? Who knows? Who cares? Is what more what the Buddha said is these things aren't worthy of contemplation. They're not worthy of paying any attention to. These philosophical, how many angels dance on the head of a pin things that a lot of philosophical constructs get involved with because they don't lead anywhere. They're just stuff that the mind gets distracted by and try because we all we're trying to do is figure them all out. We're trying to figure out is it this way or is it that way? And he's saying basically you just don't waste any time doing this. Spend that time in practice instead. In actual looking at what's actually there. What's something you can actually experience with your own body mind as opposed to that figuring out energy, which is just I wouldn't say it's unwholesome, but it's useless. It's just useless. It just gets in the way of doing something more useful, like practice. Okay. But we go on. Here he says, and how has a monk given up seeking? Here a monk has abandoned the search for sensual pleasures. and the search for becoming, and is suspended at the search for a holy life. In this way, the monk has given up seeking. I found this kind of interesting.
Yeah.
Abandoning sensual pleasures, yeah, that's a pretty constant theme in the Buddhist teachings. The search for becoming. Becoming meaning understanding I'm this. I'm a certain kind of self. Selfing, as we say in this world these days. And then he says, an abandoned up, suspended search for a holy life. Why would you want to give up a search for the holy life? There's a, once again, another famous sutta. This is from the Majjhima Nikaya. And it's actually a famous simile. The Buddha used a lot of similes to teach because he tried to make things understandable by using common images. Bhikkhus. This is called the simile of the raft. And some of you have probably heard me talk about this before. It's one of my favorite little bits of sutta. Bhikkhus, suppose a man in the course of a journey saw a great expanse of water whose near shore was dangerous and fearful and whose further shore was safe and free from fear. But there was no ferry boat or bridge for going to the far shore. So here you are, he's wandering along. He's come to this body of water he has to get across, but there's no boat, no ferry, there's no way to get across. This is a repeated image in the Buddhist teachings where the body of water, sometimes called, the flood, is what arises constantly in the mind. And we have to somehow get across. No sense trying to stop a flood, but if I can somehow figure out how to get across the flood so that I'm no longer swept away by the contents of my mind. Okay. Then he thought, there is the great expanse of water whose near shore is dangerous and fearful and whose farther shore is safe and free from fear. So it's dangerous because on this shore the kalesas arise and all these temptations arise. On the far shore, we've abandoned all of that. Suppose I collect grass, twigs, branches, and leaves and bind them together into a raft, and supported by the raft and making an effort with my hands and feet, I got safely across to the far shore. And then that's what he does. But notice what he's making the raft out of here. This isn't like, oh, I better, cut down some trees and make a raft and then build a little hut on the raft to keep all my stuff in and put up a mast and I'll have to weave some cloth to make a sail. And he's not making a big deal out of it. He's just saying, okay, I'm just going to collect what's here right now in the moment, what's here, some grass, some twigs, and some branches, and ties them all together and makes what pretty much is going to be a pretty flimsy raft, right? And then propelling it with his hands and feet, which means he's with his own effort, having created this raft, he gets across to the other side. The raft is the symbol for the Dhamma, the teachings of the Buddha. And so the raft is there, but we have to propel ourselves across the flood with our own arms and legs to get to the other side. Then, when he's got across and has arrived at the far shore, he might think thus, this raft has been very useful to me, since supported by it and making an effort with my hands and feet, I got safely across. Suppose I were to hoist it on my head or load it on my shoulder and then go wherever I want. Now, bhikkhus, what do you think? By doing so, would the man be doing what should be done with that raft? No, venerable sir. By doing what would the man be doing that should be done with this raft? Here, bhikkhus, when the man has got across and has arrived at the far shore, you might think thus, this raft has been very helpful to me. I got across safely. Suppose I haul it onto dry land or set it adrift in the water and then go wherever I want. Abandon the raft. Abandon the Dhamma. At a certain point, you have to let go of even that. It's just another thing to cling to. This is a hard one to take in, I think, because it's just like, well, I need the Dhamma. Put up my hand for that one. I need the Dhamma to sort of help me understand and get across to the other side. You know, but once you're on the other side, you no longer need the Dhamma. That's what, you know, this verse says, he suspended the search for a holy life. I found the holy life. I don't need to search for it anymore. Once I found it, once I've got to the other side, I don't have to search anymore. I've given up even the search for a holy life. There's another meaning here, and that's that we have to be careful we don't think that what we're doing is turning into some holy person. You know, we're searching for a holy life, like, oh, I'm going to be one of those holy people. You know, it's which is easy to go there too. If we're not careful, because that just is a huge distraction. It's like the ego popping up, but saying, oh, it's okay because I'm being so holy. And we have to be very careful not to end up in that place as well. So that's another separate meaning you see in some commentaries about this. But I like the idea of actually abandoning the teachings completely, because they've got us to the other side. We don't need them anymore to actually have a holy life. Okay, we go on. It's undisturbed. And how monk has a monk clarified his thoughts? Here, monks, a monk has abandoned sensual thoughts, thoughts of ill will and thoughts of violence. It has made, in this way, a monk has clarified his thoughts. So here's the three poisons. He's clarified his thoughts. Don't need any of these things. And he's abandoned them again. And this is like, you know, what the whole Metta Sutta is about. The whole Metta Sutta is about abandoning these unwholesome thoughts by filling the mind with wholesome ones. That's the whole teaching on Metta, and why the teachings on Metta are so important in the Buddhist teachings. It's like, it's really, the Metta is like a method, skillful means for abandoning on these unwholesome thoughts of greed, hatred, and delusion. Of wanting things, of not wanting things, of being deluded by what you want, and just actually having a mind full of loving kindness. It goes on. And how has a monk calmed the bodily formation? Here, monks, with the abandoning of pleasure and pain, and with the previous passion way of joy and sadness, a monk enters and dwells in the fourth jhana, which is neither painful nor pleasant, and includes the purification of mindfulness by equanimity. In this way, a monk has calmed down the bodily formation. So this is describing what happens fairly deep into the process at the level of body, however, still. There's still bodily sensation. But it's like the body has become so still and the mind has become so concentrated. The fourth jhana is basically the top level of the four jhanas, where the mind is totally concentrated and there's nothing going on that distracts us. There's a sense of equanimity is quite strong. But there's another interesting thing. This is another one of these interesting footnotes which I came across, and I thought, oh, this is sort of interesting. Here. He's saying at the bottom, when he says bodily formation has been stilled, it's the in and out breathing. This subsides when you're deeply concentrated. So even the sense of the breath moving disappears at this point. This is where bodily sensation starts to become much less obvious. And it's and here I actually I'm speaking from experience of having hung out in this place for a while at various times in my practice. At a certain point when you're practicing and you're in deeply concentrated states, if you look, you can't find the breath. And that's the only way I can describe it. Like, there's no motion of breath at all. Obviously, you must still be breathing somehow because you're staying alive and awake, right? But there's no physical, the bodily formation, the bodily process of breath, even that has gone. And then, of course, that what comes from that is the sense of body completely disappears, where there's just no body home, so to speak. It's you transcend bodily sensation completely, and it's you're at some sort of purely mental plane. That's where the fourth jhana experience is like, where you're just in this space of stillness on a purely mental level, because the body has gone perfectly still and you don't notice it anymore. Okay, but it's still more to go here, right? Then he says, and how is a monk well liberated in mind? Here, monks, a monk's mind is liberated from lust, hatred, and delusion. In this way, a monk is well liberated in mind. It basically means you no longer even experience. There's no mental formation of any of the three poisons: lust, greed, anger, delusion. They're all just gone. Just gone. That also arises at the level of the fourth jhana, where those things just no longer affect you. But you're not finished. This is the tricky part. It's like, oh, because when you get to these very still, calm states, you think, I got it. I figured it all out. And actually, there's still more to do, because there's still the sense of a separate self at a subtle mental level, which is what the Buddha talks about when he talked about the night of his awakening. He said everything was fine, except I was still stuck. And I realized that what was left was I still had a subtle sense of a separate self. And when I could abandon that, then enlightenment arose. So we're still, even in this calm, still space that's being described here, there's still a sense of a separate self. It's like me being still. It's subtle, but it's definitely there still. Then he says, and here's the last one, and how is a monk well liberated by wisdom? Here, monks, a monk understands, lust, hatred, and delusion have been abandoned by me, cut off at the root, made barren like palm tree stumps, obliterated so there are no more subject to arise in the future. In this way, a monk is well liberated in wisdom. So now, this monk has reached enlightenment. The final stage. We're at number 10, right? And then he says, whatever noble ones in the past, O monks, abided in the noble abodes, all abided in just these 10 noble abodes. Whatever noble ones in the future will abide in noble abodes, all will abide in just these 10 noble abodes. Whatever ones at present abide in the noble abodes, all abide in just these 10 noble abodes. So he's saying, what he's describing here is the common experience, both in the past, with people before the Buddha's time, because according to the Buddha, there were other people back there, like further back in time, in history, before recorded history, essentially. There was, and he's talking about, well, people right now, well, it's because he has students who are abiding there. And he's saying, but also in the future, this is what it will be like in the future. This set of 10 abodes and the process of going through them, in a sense, is the common factor in all awakenings, without exception. That all everyone will who is awakened will have will abide in these abodes, will hang out here. This is where we're all headed. This is where the practice takes people. And it's like I find that sort of reassuring. To be honest with you, it's like, oh, he's actually figured out this is how things go. This is the process that the body mind goes through over time as you go deeper into the practice, and can describe it so succinctly with this particular teaching, where he just takes these pieces of his teaching from all these different places and puts them all in one sutta and says, and this is what's going to happen. This is what happens. It's always happened this way. It will always happen this way in the future. This is the way things are for people who are practicing and moving in this direction. Which I find it reassuring that he can say this so clearly and lay it out so clearly. I have, of course, if I can find, I have a piece of poetry here someplace. Ah, there it is. This is from Mary Oliver's book, Why I Wake Early. And it's a poem called Logos. And she's talking about what the Buddha was talking about here in very poetic language, in a different way, but it seems very similar to me. Why wonder about the loaves and fishes? If you say the right words, the wine expands. If you say them with love, and the felt ferocity of that love, and the felt necessity of that love, the fish explode into many. Imagine him speaking. And don't worry about what is reality, or what is plain, or what is mysterious. If you were there, it was all those things. If you can imagine it, it is all those things. Eat, drink, be happy, accept the miracle, accept too each spoken word spoken with love. That's the other part of this, is that. And we can't forget that at the same time, it's this beautiful description the Buddha has in the sutta. It's also the heart part of this practice. It's like there's this deep, concentrated mind state, but that deep, concentrated mind state opens the heart wide and takes in and be compassionate for everyone without exception. It's just the other. Sometimes you hear the Dhamma described as a bird. It's got two wings. It's this deep, concentrated mindfulness process, and then love. And we need to remember that both have to be there. We don't. Sometimes when we read things and study things like this sutta, it's like it seems all so sort of mental. But if the heart isn't open, what good's that going to do? So it's finding that balance between those two, I think, is also really important, which is partly why I read this poem, of course.